Conference is being recorded.
Welcome to eDemocracy.org's Citizen Media and Online Engagement webinar. This is part one, where we're going to do an overview of citizen media. I have a picture here I want you to take a look at. It's an arrow for pointing. Okay, here we go. And just kind of absorb this for a moment. All right. So we're going to do 35 minutes or so on citizen media and online engagement, have a quick five-minute break, and then 45 minutes on issues forums. The total talk time from now will still probably take a full 90 minutes. If you have to leave early, we are recording this for people's access afterwards. Okay. All right, so this is what I look like, just to give you a sense about who's on the other end of the line. It's obviously a little different than meeting me in person or meeting each other in person at a conference. So something to point out, when you think about a lot of online tools that people are using to engage one another, we often sort of bunch them all together. And I think if you look at these pictures of someone in Hyde Park, two ladies chatting in a park, some friends, a social network. Imagine that you had a little exercise where you have to draw a line between web feed and which image represents the web feed. And for me, it's the person here, one way speaking to folks. The social network are a group of friends. The blog is the person in Hyde Park. The forum is the counter at the cafe or the discussion group on the weekend. The working group is a neighborhood meeting. The online consultation are people, you know, raising their hands in a large crowd. This is my favorite, not really my favorite, this is my view of what online news and blog comments are. It's a big argument and fight in many cases. And I think it's important to realize that with different tools that we use, we often have different goals in mind. And it's not just about grabbing a tool, it's often about knowing what goal is in mind and attempting to find the right mix of tools. So my definition of citizen media, and it changes from week to week, but essentially it's about the use of online tools by the public to express themselves, to share news, etc. It's often done by individuals. We do see media organizations, encourage user-generated content. We also see new associations, new groups that are created around an online effort to use these types of tools. Rural Voices, to give you a little context, a number of you are involved in just efforts to start new issues forums as funded by the Blandin Foundation. And we have basically three issues forums, actually four, that are going to be two just opened and two more in the progress. And that's what the focus of the next session will be. But we do have a special interest here at eDemocracy around how you enable citizen media and online engagement in small rural communities. In general, the output that I see coming from citizen media is news, information, expression, conversation would be another term. Online engagement is sort of where I've actually had more personal experience, and it's about trying to use online tools to engage people in public life. And in this case, I'm thinking of the highly interactive use of social media, whether it be wikis or blogs or other tools, and not just in private life, not just using Facebook to talk to friends and family, but using such tools to talk to your neighbors or talk to your government and the like. There are sort of two main streams of online engagement. There's citizen to citizen, the things that are sort of where people talk to each other in a place, and there's government institutional based. So if the government puts up a website and says, "Give us input," or a nonprofit or some other organization that basically says, "Give us feedback or engage with us and help us make decisions and the like." The output is a little different when you talk about online engagement. Conversation is actually a big starting point. I should have had that term on both slides. I don't. But it's participation, informed public, expression, better decisions, public problem solving, community building. And the honest truth is, particularly when I deal a lot with the media as a host of online engagement, or citizen media for that matter, things are very kind of blurry. A lot of folks that are coming from a journalism perspective are creating sites that are really about community building. And then there are people who are doing community building projects like New Democracy that actually generates a lot of news. It's often sort of based on your frame of reference that you describe it in one camp or the other. I think there's a lot of gray and a lot of blending in terms of roles. Because this session is being hosted by edemocracy.org, I think it's important to define edemocracy a little bit for folks in a generic context. And for us, it's really about how all these different sectors, the government, political groups, the private sector, how are they all using the internet, the media, to provide their information, to provide places for interactivity, to provide sort of what they do based on who they are. And what edemocracy.org tries to do differently is instead of just replicating, you know, sort of a historical role, we're trying to take that perspective, what we call the youth citizen or the person, you know, as they're being influenced by all these different groups online. And so how do you leverage the press releases from the political groups or the reports from the government or the connectivities in the private sector or the online news, and to have a space that's basically citizen to citizen? That's sort of our main focus and, to be honest, bias. So we're going to run through a whole bunch of different sort of citizen media type projects. And, you know, I look forward to any of your questions about these. And also, if you have any examples that you think are really outstanding that I'm not highlighting here, if you put it in the chat session, I'll cut and paste that, and I'll make that available to folks afterwards as examples that are similar to those that I'm highlighting. There's a site called placeblogger.com, which also lists lots and lots of place blogs. And the general idea is that when people started doing blogs, it was often very much about who they were as a person, or political blogs, very much about national politics. But then folks, in this case, this is the blogging started in 2003 or 4, sort of blogging about place. And this is a Pelican Rapids blog, 56572 is the zip code. It actually stopped last summer and was on hold for 8 months, and I thought it was done, but now it's restarted. And it's a great example of just some down-home conversation. And a lot of it's more journalistic in the sense that there's not a lot of chatter on there, but it you know, highlights photos and different stories in town. Another place blog that's also in Minnesota that's kind of really interesting to point out is locally grown Northfield.org. And Griff Wigley and others down in Northfield basically have generated this cluster of the three of them that edit stories, and they have a blogosphere in the community also tied to work involved with a different organization called Northfield.org. And they also recently got a grant for a representative journalism project. So they basically have sort of hired their own journalist in town, and this screenshot actually comes from that page. Something to point out, I'm not sure whether they just weren't running their ads or they're getting ready to run ads, but the issue of how do you sustain these models is a very important one. And the more news that you generate, the more expensive it can be, particularly if you want to generate news on a regular basis. The quality, I often will say that talk is cheap or conversations cost effective relative to a lot of these types of news sharing sites. Another example of citizen media that I find quite compelling is local photo sharing communities. Typically on Flickr, almost every place on Flickr, for example, Winona, if you go to the Winona page on Flickr, this is sort of an auto-generated page about Winona. They map out where pictures are taken, if they're tagged such, and it also will link to any related groups or public groups on Flickr. So there's a Winona, Minnesota group, I believe, with about 30 members. There's also, there's probably about, at least in the Minnesota context, there's at least a dozen or so local, sort of smallish town groups, as well as lots of different statewide groups. One of the ones that I wanted to point out was the Minnesota Roadside Marvels group. And here you have an image of the Jolly Green Giant. So if you know the Jolly Green Giant, ho, ho, ho. And lots of fun. Another project that actually eDemocracy was involved with, the Blennett Foundation, misspelled Bell Museum there, but they funded the Bell Museum's Minnesota Minute. They did a whole big public service announcement campaign as part of our sesquicentennial and sort of celebrating Minnesota's nature and environment. And they ran a lot of these 60-second ads on television, highly produced, you know, HD, you name it, But then to complement that, they had an online video contest. Jennifer Armstrong, who's on the call with us, did a lot of outreach along with a couple other people. But the general idea is we went on YouTube and we looked for people who did videos that already were about Minnesota nature, as well as encouraged people to create new ones. And there was basically a 20-week contest where they would highlight a couple new videos each week. And there were about 50 submissions, which is actually is quite a lot for a smaller scale, non-national online video contest. But it's an example of how they basically leveraged YouTube for something that had sort of a community public interest. The next example is local Twittering. You probably don't know this, but if you go to search.twitter.com, and you actually can't automatically access the search engine on Twitter from the homepage, so it's kind of buried. But if you go to search.twitter.com and then you go into advanced, you can actually ask for real-time results within a certain distance of a place. Now, it doesn't have everybody in there. And you obviously can also just search by different keyword terms for a place to find out who's talking about a certain place. But it's pretty interesting. And one of the things that emerged in Minnesota at statewide was basically the night we had that near tie for the U.S. Senate race, myself and one other person at the Pioneer Press decided to do pound MN recount. And what that means, it's called a hashtag. I call it a channel. But essentially, you can create organic groups. So, you know, I expect that, you know, for the inauguration, for example, people did pound inaug 09 as an example. And in Minnesota, there's been thousands and thousands of people who have posted short little pithy things on the MN Recount Twitter channel. And essentially, there are people who are following the video live about the recount in the courts right now or when they're doing the recount. And would comment on it. And I have an example of Cover It Live coming up here. I didn't actually make a slide, so I'll just mention it now. There's a project called theuptake.org, which is a video streaming-oriented citizen media project that uses a service called Cover It Live for basically live blogging of various events. And it's pretty similar to a Twitter stream, but it allows, for dozens of people to comment about things as things are happening. And theuptake.org is definitely worth a look. And what you'll also find is a lot of sites now will have their own, well, here's an example, actually, their own Twitter channel. So as the Daily Planet or MinPost, which are two journalism-oriented online media projects, you can also follow them, and they will send you notes about major happenings either on their site or in the community. You see this integration happening where people basically, they call it, grab a feed off of Twitter or some other service and use that. Because why? Because that's where the bodies are, right? And so it's a lot easier to use a service like that than to create your own or to, you know, leverage Facebook or MySpace. The Twin Cities Daily Planet is a really interesting case. While they do do some funding for original news, what I think they stand out for is their amazing network they've built of their media partners. And a lot of it is neighborhood and ethnic press. Dozens of different entities that maybe even don't even have their own website or have a basic website and don't have a lot of traffic. They basically monitor these dozens of sources for news from an African newspaper, African immigrant newspaper that might actually be of interest to the broader community, and then they highlight it there. Our local newspaper local newsletter for our neighborhood did an article on issues forums in the neighborhood where I live, and it ended up on the Daily Planet. So it's a really interesting model. A lot of the issues about these models are like, how do you generate enough content based on the resources you have? And in this case, showing how they can aggregate. It provides value to all. Another example is looking good on Wikipedia. Now, this is kind of a quirky one that I'd like to point out, but if you're in a community and you're thinking about economic development, if you're thinking about, what do people think of us who don't know much about us but are coming our way, if you go to Google and you type in Pine City, Minnesota, the number 3 hit is their Wikipedia page. And if you look for almost any place that you do a search on, if there's a Wikipedia page about it, it's pretty much always in the top 10. And a lot of pages about different communities are what they call stubs, or very short entries with not too well-developed content. So we have a discussion in Minnesota. It's called the Minnesota Voices Online Project, and it's if you go to e-democracy.org/mnvoices, it's an online community of people who are interested in citizen media and online engagement in rural Minnesota. And we had a discussion about, you know, what are some of the best Wikipedia pages, and we got a note from someone in Pine City, I think it was actually someone who works for the city, who said they spent a lot of time, they looked at various models for how to, you know, sort of fill out a city page, and this is sort of my comparison. Hinckley, which is just up the road in the same county, sort of the big competitor, to they each have about 3,000, I think, in population. Hinckley's page is this little short one. Pine City's is almost, you know, not as long as Duluth, but Duluth is, you know, a town of over 100,000. So you get a sense about all the photos and different elements that someone put together to represent their community. And Wikipedia, obviously, is a very interactive type of site in the sense that users can generate and update and correct content. Even though a very small percentage do, there's an advantage to doing that. Another wiki example, and I see Steve Magruder texted me that Louisville, Kentucky's page is featured, so that must be a good example of a local site. Thank you, Steve. Community Wiki. This is there's actually a network, Kickapoo, Wisconsin. It's sort of some valleys in southwestern Wisconsin, and they have a citizen media blog/news site, discussion site, and they also created a community wiki. We have something like that that hasn't been updated too actively recently, but it's a Citizen's Guide to St. Paul. The general idea is that, you know, you can have a distributed community directory. We use this actually to gather information on candidates for office in Minneapolis, you know, 6 months before they actually run for, you know, file for office. We have a wiki page in eDemocracy where candidates and others can say who's running and where their website is and who their campaign manager is and how to contact them. And it's a very distributed way to gather information. The key lesson on this, as you can see, this looks like a very structured wiki, is that wikis kind of work like people's brains, right? So if people have sort of, you know, lots of random thoughts and they put up lots of random pages, it's very difficult to navigate. If you spend a little time thinking about how you want to actually organize the information, even though wikis are very flexible, if you create a bit of structure, like deciding there's going to be a page called government or a page called arts and entertainment, providing that level of structure is a really good starting point. And our experience is that if you want to get others to sort of submit and improve wiki pages, you have to seed them. It may be that you actually do, honestly, two-thirds of the work up front to give it, make it there, and then that creates an incentive for others to add and embellish. I mentioned Flickr earlier. Here's a great example of a project that, you know, you can just put this up as a screensaver, or maybe someday you'll get this right into your HDTV. But basically, it's a site that, as photos come into Flickr based on place, it pops them up on a map. So here's a rainbow in some fishing village in Scotland. And it's just fascinating to watch sort of humanity flashing in front of you. And it doesn't allow you, when you zoom in, it just takes you around the world. But I'd love, for example, to be able to have just a Minnesota version of this, you know, something that you could imagine on the wall, the governor's office or something, where someone just sort of shows, you know, how the state is sharing its story as an example. All right. So the next one, got two slides about this one. This is a project called everyblock.com. And Everyblock, they got some real decent Knight Foundation funding, like $1 million, right? So they got some real money to do this. It's a follow-on from a site called chicagocrime.org, and I think they serve about 10 cities now. And they basically go in, and they basically try to get as much data out of a city as possible. Crime, health records, they aggregate stuff from like sites like Yelp and other places. And basically, if there's an address or an intersection, they can pin it on a map. And these little orange dots that you see on this screen represent the number of records related to that address, and I'm not sure the time frame. It's not just crime in this case, but this one was on narcotics possession from January 24th. So that was a recent incident there. And on their homepage, they actually have also reused this government data to sort of show the pattern of crime. You can see the different crime by type, so theft, battery, criminal damage, where it happens, street, residence, apartment, sidewalk, other. You can browse citywide. You got crimes, property transfers, foreclosure auctions, restaurant inspections, city press releases. It's a really interesting project. They tend to be focusing on larger cities, so I know they're in Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and the like. And I'd love to have them, you know, come to expand to more communities. The key concept here, and this runs through all sorts of different areas, is how can we ensure or make it so that government can provide more access to its raw data so that others, perhaps others that have more creativity or flexibility, can use and reuse that information in ways that the government won't or really can't justify doing because they don't have the tax dollars to spend on a fancy site like EveryBlock. But if they made their data available, it could be integrated into the local newspaper website or others. And one of the key sort of extensions of this is that if it's sort of data-driven, you have the ability to, actually, it brings up the next slide, create conversations based on things on maps. This is a project in the United Kingdom called Fix My Street, fixmystreet.com. And they're, instead of using Google Maps, they're actually using I think it's like the Ordnance Survey or something, but it's a really detailed map that actually shows the outlines of buildings all across the entire country of the United Kingdom. And, you know, it costs some money to access that for them, but it allows them to be very, very detailed. And so someone basically can put a pin in the map. In this case, this one said there's a light flickering in the bus stop. And what they've done is they've mapped through, see, in the UK, there's like only 250 or 260 different types of local councils. And for the most part, in the US, it's like thousands, like 4,000 or something like that. Maybe it's 20,000. I think it's 20,000. So there they were able to sort of map through where do all the complaints go? And then they basically hook the map through. But what's interesting is that they actually send you an email after you submit this, and you can say whether or not things were fixed. And it'll update the map. And other people can comment about different things that have been put on the map. So basically you can have a conversation around a pothole. They've also have applications for BlackBerry, and this is the picture of the iPhone application. I went through the demo. And basically, in this case, you can take a photo, you can give it some text, you can find a location, somehow, some way, GPS or whatever, and then, enter your details and send it in. And then that'll, another way that you can actually pin on the map with a mobile device. It's pretty darn cool. So, another project, and this is kind of small, perhaps, from the text here, but it's a site called delicious.com. And it's owned by Yahoo, and basically it's one of these social bookmarking sites. It's also a site called Furl and some others. But essentially it allows you to tag web pages or websites and in a way that allows you to share and aggregate them with others. So in this case, the library in Hibbing, Minnesota, some of the library decided to use that as a way to tag lots of different posts in their community. And I haven't found other examples like this where sort of someone in a very local community was sort of doing this in a community interest way. I'm sure they are out there. But you'll find if you go to delicious.com and probably put in a place name, you'll probably find a lot of things about that have been linked to about your town. And this might be an interesting project for other libraries to think about how they can, instead of just having a great list of links on their own website, maybe there are ways for them to put links that they gather into the blog, or sorry, into the sort of the Web 2.0 ecology, if you will. So that's an interesting example. We've also used this with the MN Voices project. If you type in MN Voices, one word as a tag, we created a unique tag about basically blogs and other sites in greater Minnesota that were are doing this kind of stuff, citizen media and the like. We've also used it as a tag for a tag called MN Politics. And if you create a tag that no one else uses and then promote it, others to use it, it's kind of like your own little tagging community. So you can distribute the work out so other people can, you know, be tagging, and you can have basically a feed of all the tags that say the same thing. The key thing is to pick, in this case, a unique tag that others aren't using, MN Politics, MN Voices. So local groups online, part two, we're going to talk a lot more in depth about local groups online. But I wanted to point out that even though Yahoo Groups has been around forever, or Google Groups have been around forever, you really don't want to underestimate the power of email and the power of technology choice. And in this case, it's a Minnesota homestead group, people who are basically going back to the land with small farms, basically trying to live off the land. It's about 30 people, and it's a private group, but it's a, you know, in this case, they're able to use it to communicate with each other. And then one of the topics was I joined it and I popped in, and I'm not homesteading, but they're talking about, you know, raising, you know, bringing in just tips on raising chickens, for example. There's a site called Groups, and you're actually very jealous of it because it's something I'd love to be involved with more. And basically, the idea is that, you know, there's lots of different local groups across the net. Why don't we have a good directory of them so people can find them? I run, for example, through Democracy and Issues Forum at the neighborhood level in Spanish Erickson here. And so I believe we put it in the directory here. So if someone happens upon it, they might find us. And one of the biggest challenges with local online groups in general, the biggest challenge is that word of mouth is pretty much the only way people find out about these things. And so if you don't know somebody who already knows about it, it's kind of unlikely that you will stumble upon it, unless perhaps it's linked from like a neighborhood website. But a lot of these local groups sort of are obscure and hard to find. All right, I need to pick up the pace here a little bit. Local Facebook groups. Facebook groups are primarily virtual lapel pins, as far as I can tell. It's a way for someone to say, I identify with this effort. The actual functionality of groups and the actual discourse and discussion, I just don't see it. I mean, maybe you can help me find them, but there aren't a lot of groups that are really, really active, as far as I can tell. Or if they're really active, that means it's because they have 100,000 people. And smaller groups, I just don't see the activity, except I should say there's probably a number of private groups on Facebook that are active, but you can't see them because they're private. Two examples here. And I think it's important that Facebook in particular, and I'm sure MySpace historically, but Facebook a lot is based on real identity and building trust among friends and family and alike, and sort of extending out from there. And so a lot of the networking on Facebook is about private life. And I'm very interested in how people extend that into their public life. And so if you go to Facebook, in this case it's a Duluth group of students, they're all mostly high school kids, that were basically in favor of passing the referendum, and then when the referendum failed to, you know, give more money to the schools, there's some nice profanity about the you know, the folks in the community. Steve McGruder texted through one about bury the damn power lines already. It's a very new group and exploding with members and has good discussion. So that's a great example. I have found people have done some research on trying to figure out how do you get a million people in a Facebook group, and the ones that are a million people tend to be the ones about Facebook. Like, I hate the new design. So if you have something really snarky in the title, or there's one group called well, I won't say it verbatim, but basically those Crocs might be comfortable, but you look like a. So I'll stop there. But that has over like 1.3 million people who don't like Crocs, those sandals. Very strange. All right, so there's another group called Living the Ojibwe Language, and I point that one out because Cass Lake, where we also have an issues forum, is a majority Native American area. And when we were doing outreach, one of the things to launch that forum, we were looking for groups in Facebook, and we did find a Facebook group for people who said that they had voted on Cass Lake, and it was mostly like teenagers and people in their 20s that, you know, they flew in, had fun on the lake, and took off, versus people who actually lived in Cass Lake. But we did find this group, and we posted to the wall, they call it the wall, and basically encouraged people to join the local forum. So finding Facebook groups, and in particular, each Facebook group owner has the ability to email others. So if you're trying to do recruitment, if you send them the Facebook group owner, and you can justify it, like we did one to someone created a Facebook group called Little Mogadishu, which is related to sort of the Cedar Riverside area, the Riverside Plaza of Minneapolis, where we're launching a neighborhood forum. And, you know, there's like, I don't know, must have been about 60 mostly Somali members of that group, and they sent an email to every member encouraging them to join our forum. If we didn't ask them, they wouldn't have obviously passed it on. So I'm going to shift now from sort of the online citizen media focus to talking about a bunch of online engagement examples. I think a lot of folks didn't realize that you could do this kind of thing in government or from a civic perspective until change.gov sort of showed up. And I'm going to tell you about why what they did was amazing. Whitehouse.gov has, though so far, while they've made some promises about some interactivity, it's basically turned off anything that's two-way until they can figure out how to do it right, potentially legally. But Change.gov took a lot of risks. It had a thing called the Citizen Briefing Book, where over 500,000 people submitted different ideas and comments on different. I think it was like 30,000 ideas with 500,000 comments. But essentially, you could submit ideas, and they said the best, the top-ranked ideas, which then people could rank ideas, would be put into a briefing book that would be given to the president. They had a discussion where they put up a question of the week and have a discussion, and sometimes it was quite good. Other times it was hijacked based on what was kind of going on in the news. They used a tool, in this case I think it was called Google Moderator, and they were willing to experiment with external tools, which is very rare in government to see them use a third-party service with one of the challenges, third-party terms of service. But they allowed you, again, to sort of vote up and down different comments. The idea is to try to allow the cream to rise to the top. They had a thing called Your Seat at the Table, which is actually quite important and maybe hasn't gotten as much attention, but basically they acknowledge that there are groups in society, and groups might have, like, documents they will want to share with the transition. Only in Estonia have I heard of sort of a government thinking about how to allow online input via groups versus just sort of everybody as an autonomous individual. In this case, you could upload a PDF in the your seat at the table, and it would go, and you could tag it, and it would go into various places. I'm not sure who or how they read through all the different submissions. And then they also had it open for questions. They had a Q&A system. There is an online consultation community of practice that I host on a different website called dowire.org. There's about 250 people there. And basically the last decade, most interest in this e-consultation, e-participation, e-panels, whatever term you might use, has been in Europe and in Canada. And now that the White House has begun to do this, I'm hoping, actually the White House will do more of this, the federal government will do more, and people begin to ask the question, well, if the White House can do it, why can't local communities, why can't levels of government that are closer to the people also give them a public space online? Big question, because for the most part, having worked in e-government myself, it's a one-way show. And when I have an article called Sidewalks for Democracy Online, if you want to dig more into this, but I basically make the argument that the primary interface to government is now one way. When you're in line at City Hall, you can talk to the person in line with you. You can grab a newspaper. Someone can protest on the sidewalk. Now the number one interface for government is completely one way and fundamentally anti-democratic, and that's not the history of this country, or those are here in the U.S. And I want to point that out because while it'd be nice to have more citizen activity, hosting interactivity, ultimately if government is just one way, we're in trouble. Someone asked a question about the book, and so there's an article, and it's called Sidewalks for Democracy Online, and it's publicus.net, and just go to the articles section, or just type in Sidewalks for Democracy Online into Google, and that I'm sure will take you right to it. And it's a short article. It's actually part of a series, a book called Rebooting America, that the Personal Democracy Forum commissioned. Lots of good, interesting ideas in there. So let's realize that there's actually been a lot of online engagement activities at different levels in different places before change.gov. And this is actually a fairly rare U.S. example. In Moundsview, Minnesota, the school district had a thing about schools talking about diversity and the like. And they had a booklet they encouraged people to read. But not only did they have the booklet that you could read, they then said, well, now here's what we want to then what you can do online. They gave like three different options. One thing I want to point out that I think is really important for any site that's seeking to engage people is to have a lot of people to opt in for email relationships. No matter how good or bad your website is, if people can't say, tell me what's new, and if you don't have permission to tell them what's new, you'd never bring them back. And so it's really important. Here they actually have a whole set of different e-updates. And don't settle for RSS feeds. Only like 7% of people use them. Email is the way to go for normal people online in terms of notification. And what they did then, for the system, they had an online Survey Monkey, very simple. Did you, read it? And then you could answer like, 10 different questions. And they also gave you the option to, in 150 words or less, share your comments. And what I thought was really interesting about this was that they basically had said, read this. They had a question, and they basically limited people. They asked for real names and where city you were in, which is also very rare. They said that they had rules about no personal attacks or profanity, and they actually moderated this. While that might not seem radical for those who live outside the United States, the idea of government like taking down information is maybe thought to be a violation of the First Amendment, or perhaps not. So maybe they made this stuff accessible in a different way if they actually removed it. And I guess they probably didn't remove more than one comment, if any. I don't know for sure what they did. But what's nice about this is that it basically constrained people based on space. It used names for accountability, and it's just that if you read through it, you get some really thoughtful input. And it's not just about a one-way black box into government. It's actually about those who are attempting to influence their local school board or the school to react to actually influence one another. That's what engagement's about to me. So another example of some good things that I've seen out there, the state of Queensland has a democracy portal, consultation portal, and they have all sorts of different, they actually have a e-democracy policy they built all this upon and some budgets, and they provide services to different ministries to help them do online engagement. And another site, which is a real leader, is askbristol.com. And there they have webcasts, you can find consultations, they have sort of questions they put up for online discussion, they have e-petitions, and they webcast the public meetings. And I refer to this sort of the democracy portal where you pull it all together. If you ever work in the government, and I have, your primary thing is this, how do you get people out of line? How do you serve them? How do you get them a transaction? And that's actually what most people want. And the democracy stuff, if it's often sort of like, click on the hierarchy of the council and then maybe you'll get some input or advice on how you can contact your city official. To me, it's really important to actually channel the engagement democracy stuff into a unique section that pulls it all together. And that's pretty rare, and these are some great examples of that. Speaking of petitions, when we think of petitions in the United States, primarily petitions are about what an interest group does in order to acquire emails, in order to ask people for money, and then send a lot of sort of stuff to the virtual circular bin in Congress, to be honest. It's in the UK, however, they've actually set up a system on the number 10 Downing Street, the Prime Minister's website, on the government site, where they have a process for submitting electronic petitions. There's a number of councils, in this case it's Kingston upon Thames, where you can submit petitions. And there's different systems. I mean, some petitions you post a petition. There's actually a review process to make sure it's in a legitimate level of government to have this petition, and then it resides on the government site. If you fill this out, this is about a free garden waste collection petition in Kingston. You actually can opt in to allow the author of the petition to contact you. That's a really key thing, is that, so what good is a petition if the person who starts it can actually then organize with people? And so in this case, people can opt in to communication. There's a little article from the Times of London, but basically, there's a big issue about road, basically taxing people on how far they drove, and over 1 million people signed that petition, and it generated headline news. So that's pretty unique. And we do have a right to petition government in our constitution as well, but it's no one in government has ever thought about having it actually be a more formal system here. Another example of a place to look into, I don't have a link here for more information, but basically Estonia has had all kinds of different projects. They're a country of 2 million. Everyone has their own little, I don't know how you feel about single IDs, they basically have their own secure ID. And so when they establish identity, not just in this case about like Today I Decide, which is like a deliberative petition system. They've also then allowed people to see documents as they're being drafted, deep into the agencies. And they have a thing called X-Road or Crossroad, where, while it's not engagement per se, it's about transparency and trust. You can then securely log in, if you have a card reader on your computer, which lots of people in Estonia do, and actually see private data held by government about you. You have a right to correct it. You have, or the ability to correct it. You also have, you can actually see when it's been accessed and a right to know why it's been accessed. And so someone who showed me this said, oh my gosh, my passport's been accessed 10 times in the last, you know, day. And I said to him, well, didn't you just tell me you're having lunch when the President of the United States comes to Estonia next week, when George Bush came? And he goes, oh yeah. And then it all made sense. So it's pretty funny. Example, not a funny example, but it's an illustrative example of how that system works. So I've kind of trucked around the world thinking about why don't people do live stuff on the net like we're doing this webinar. And there's actually a case in India where they had wireless low bandwidth connections with video. They had like seven villages with a chat and audio and video having a discussion with the local town sort of regional extension agent of sorts. These are often villages without roads to them, just paths. So it's a pretty interesting project. It's actually a one-off, but I think it's really important to realize that using these tools in local communities, we're sort of bandwidth rich in many places, but we're sort of like application poor. And as more and more bandwidth gets out there, more and more connectivity gets out there, it doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to use it in creative ways. You have to actually like decide you want to do that. And this is an example in India where somebody did something different. So now to end with something a little slightly more humorous. This is from Vienna, Austria, and the way you could participate in this site is that if, you saw some dog do on the sidewalk, you take a picture of it, stick in the Austrian flag, and then load it up onto this big, citywide site. And the idea is just sort of, it was a campaign to sort of encourage people to actually pick up after their dogs. And we do that pretty well here in the United States, but there's plenty of European cities where people just don't yet have the culture of picking up after their dog. So, that's a pretty funny example of doing it also with showing how sort of a more simple format can get a message across and engage people. Well, I've just talked at you now for about 45 minutes here, 40 minutes or so. I'm going to shift off of listen only, and if folks have questions, we'll do a little Q&A here before we have a break. And so think of your question, and I'll let you talk to me now.
The conference is no longer in listen-only mode.
Okay, folks, so hopefully you've heard me and you're ready to ask a couple of questions. So go ahead. And we won't move on unless I get at least two questions, so go for it.
This is Taylor. I have a question. I recall when you first started doing this work that you said a lot of your work was taking place internationally. Could you speak to sort of the international work, and are you seeing a change here at home? Are you getting to spend more time doing local consulting?
Sure. Great question, Taylor. I think it really ebbs and flows in different countries at different times. There's really in the sort of last 2 years have been actually pretty quiet except for European Union funding. For various projects, and they tend to be consortiums and research oriented and trying to commercialize stuff. It's kind of quirky. The UK had a UK local e-democracy national project, which had like about $8 million over 2 years to spend. That was real money, and they had like 30 different pilots. Italy had some money, and they developed some different projects. Australia has had interest here and there, particularly in Queensland. But the reality is that, this stuff is still sort of a sideshow when it comes to government funding. There aren't really stable funding streams, and a lot of the innovation is not spreading from country to country or within a country if it works somewhere. But ultimately, a lot of it has to be integrated into sort of the traditional democracy work. I think you tend to see a lot more interest in parliaments and legislatures because they're sort of the political arm, where the administrative branch tends to be more cautious. And in the United States, basically, we've had a lot of innovation on the online news side. So a lot of the interactivity of different things that maybe you've seen in a nonprofit or an NGO or NGO or even government to some extent in some European countries, those ideas are being tried out by different in the media here. like Minnesota Public Radio and their budget balancer. They have a great tool where you can, you know, balance the budget. And I think the finance department in Brazil did something like that, sort of similar. It was more educational for young people, and you can play around with the national budget. But in terms of the U.S., yes. I mean, I think that my argument has been that what happened last election was real in terms of people using the net to determine who the next president was. While things are temporarily sort of turned off or being developed, I don't think you can turn it all off. I think the expectations have been raised high enough. The question is whether or not it ends up working or not, whether it's a big mess, or whether, you know, folks that try to use these tools in government or in NGOs and other places actually succeed and share ideas and lessons and the like. And that jury's out. I think that what I'm worried about is that folks that are in the right place will rush into this and will sort of think that they're doing it all from scratch and not actually consult with others that have done work in this space. And there's a lot of training to do, because if it messes up, if it's done and done poorly, particularly in a larger organization, they won't do it for another 10 or 20 years. The scars will be that deep. So that helps. Is that a good answer or a decent answer?
That's a great answer. Of course, it brings up the issue of what success looks like and what failure is.
Well, that's a quick second question. I mean, how do you evaluate these activities? I mean, in many cases, they're exercises, sort of, they're experiments. But you know, did putting up that website to gather input on the survey in Mounds, for example, how much effort did it take, and how would you compare that to inviting 100 parents, whatever, to a round table discussion? What's the quality? Now, I think if you get to wait for that kind of input, so that kind of research, actually move forward with it, you know, you're never going to find the right results. But it does bring out that question of the need for research and others to sort of do some comparative analysis, because ultimately you have only so many dollars or so many hours that you can invest in different things. And you know, I can tell you that the reason the second half of the presentation is focused in on the issues forums is that I've found it to be highly cost effective relative to other things that I've done. But it's my own personal experience, not necessarily something that somebody has quantified for others. So let's do another question or two, and then if there is, and then we'll take a short break.
What would you recommend as a site for local community resource and skill sharing, not necessarily through the government, but what would you recommend as a good model? And I'll tell you what I'm thinking about. There's a movement called Transition Towns that's come out of the UK, which is communities coming together to look for solutions to the question, how can we help our community make the transition from dependence on oil, which is expected to rise dramatically over the next decade and beyond, and how can we increase our resilience economically as well as address the global warming crisis? And so there are all these citizen groups now that are forming now in the U.S., but they're like 126 in the U.K., and they want to bring people together at a geographical, you know, community level.
Let me take your
sure,
question
yeah.
on. Sorry to cut you
thank
off.
You. No, thank you.
No. It's a site called wiserearth.org, I believe, that might want to take a peek at. But think of this as a lot of e-democracy talk is about input into things, but these same interactive tools can be used for output and engaging stakeholders. And in fact, that may actually be where sort of the biggest sort of advantage to our communities comes from, where we actually sort of build this into sort of the way people solve problems. And there is a site called Community Builders New South Wales. And while it is sponsored by the government of New South Wales, it's basically 1,000 members who do community development work trading notes. They have a library, they have a forum, they have a whole different sort of whole menu of places. And I called this e-public work once, and I have an article about it. And It hasn't really gotten much attention, because it's most organizations that, like, say, buy interactive services, they might go to a site called Basecamp, for example. They might create even use Google Docs and some Google Groups to do different things. They often tend to be people who are paid to work together, or people who are there, it's their job. And when you shift from people who are there for as their job to there as sort of volunteers or there with very mixed technological bases or expertises, the tools have to be a lot easier to use. And that's where there seems to be a real gap. Although I think that, you know, honestly, if you're looking to do a group of people going to Google Groups and setting up a group and sharing some Google Docs, you can do a lot of good work with that, with those types of sort of low-cost tools. So one more question then before we have that five-minute break. We are behind, and so if you do have to leave early, like I said, we are recording this. Hopefully that recording will be good. We're not going to shorten the next section. We're still going to do 45 minutes after the break. So any one last question? If there is? Feel free. Okay, so I'm going to stop the recording now, and then we're going to then come back in at 10 after. Okay, I got 3:06 right now, so we'll make it a four-minute break. So take a quick break here.
Thank you. Please stand by.